Hello and welcome to another episode of Your Average Critics, joined today by Obi. How are you?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
Not too bad, thank you. Have you ever heard of the millennial pause?
No.
It's something that millennials tend to do on things like TikTok, where, you know, they always kind of wait a beat just to, like, before they start talking, because they're not confident that if they press like record straight away, then it's going to capture everything they say. I'm conscious that I always do this on the pod because there's always a lag from when you hit record to when.
Yeah.
I'm always having to like cut that out in the editing booth. But yeah, just made me think of that. This is our second pod of the year, and there's a few new releases that we're going to talk about. First of all, though, is there any film news that you can think of? Film or TV news?
Oh, it's got to be, isn't it? Oh, gosh. I wish I'd prepared. I know that I saw a video yesterday with Jason Momoa saying, like, he's so happy. Thank you, James Gunn. Thank you, Peter Safran. Thank you, David Zaslav, for this opportunity. And I think this is like amongst the speculation with obviously all like the DC stuff going on. I'm almost 100% certain that he's going to be announced as playing the character called Lobo instead of being Aquaman going forward.
I've kind of seen those rumors, but I don't know. Like, would you take Jason Momoa in a different character? I mean, I don't know like what the design of Lobo is, but is it not just going to look like Aquaman?
So
in terms of it being Jason Momoa.
So Lobo is like, his skin is like pale white, if that makes sense. So it's like, he'll look different. It will look like Jason Momoa, obviously, because it's Jason Momoa. But from the one iteration I've seen of Lobo, which was on season 2 of Krypton, Jason Momoa fits that character. So it would make sense. But for the person who's like not close to it, like you and I are, they would watch Lobo and be like, oh, why is Aquaman all white now and, you know, look like this kind of thing? Like, it's confusing, but I think it'll be confusing for the average consumer. But who am I to say?
Yeah. Is it? Oh, yeah, I guess it suggests that maybe there's not anyone else of Jason Momoa's physique that could take his place.
I mean, I guess, but there's always actors out there, isn't it?
Yeah, James Gunn's quite good at debunking things on Twitter, isn't he? There's always like people being like, oh, I don't know, this person's being cast as Superman. He's like, we've not even written the thing yet, how let alone cast it.
Yeah.
Which is quite good, because Twitter is just full of bullshit ITKs.
Literally. Did you want to talk about, I don't know if you can talk about the Golden Globes, maybe?
Oh, we can do, if anyone gives a shit about those. Let me get up the winners. are they relevant? I don't know. Let's see. So the winners of the Golden Globes, Austin Butler won for actor in a drama motion picture for his portrayal of Elvis. I think there was some suggestion that Brendan Fraser got snubbed for The Whale, particularly as Elvis was not put into the comedy or musical category.
That's interesting.
Yes. I mean that it's a drama film, sure, but is it not also a musical? But yeah, I mean, I guess maybe they thought he would have more of a chance of winning in the drama category than against Colin Farrell, who won for The Banshees of Inisherin as a
what
comedy
do you think
or musical.
About that?
I mean, his performance was fine. I mean, I'm not a massive fan of the film, so which puts me in a minority. But yeah, I mean, depends what you're. What I would love for these award givers to do is to kind of explain why they got the nod over someone else. Like, I would be really intrigued to understand what it was about Colin Farrell's performance or Austin Butler's performance that elevated them above their competitors.
Mm.
But you know, it, I guess, it's quite like, for, you know, for football, you'd be like, okay, well, this player is better than this player because he, his stats are better or the eye test is better. But with acting, it's all eye test, but is it, you know, Austin Butler was convincing as Elvis? I mean, I wasn't looking at that going, wow, oh my God, it really is Elvis Presley. So, yeah, that's probably the thing about film I'm still trying to, like, figure out. It's like, what... I know what, for me, makes good performances, but in terms of awards, I'm not sure.
Yeah. I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Did you ever watch The Banshees of Inisherin?
No, I didn't, you know. But I've seen this on Disney Plus. Disney Plus. So, yeah, so I might give it a try.
Yeah. Other winners were Michelle Yeoh for actress in a musical comedy for Everywhere. No, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, which was your favourite film of last year.
Yep. I'm happy about that one. I don't know who she was up against. But...
Now you're asking. Jeez. Right, let me try and find out. I'll just list some other winners. The Fablemans won drama motion picture.
Yeah, not got a chance to see that yet, obviously, because it's not out. I think it's out tomorrow, actually. Or maybe next week.
Yeah, I'm going to see it in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
So the Fablemans was up against Avatar, Elvis, Tar. I don't know if there's an accent over the A, and Top Gun Maverick. The Banshees of Inisherin won Best Musical Comedy, and it was up against Babylon, Everything Everywhere All at Once, Glass Onion, and Triangle of Sadness.
Glass Onion? Oh, piss off.
Yeah, I know, man. Babylon's also not, well, I think it might be out today as we record, but I'm seeing it next week.
I'm confident.
3 hours, 10 minutes.
Yeah, I'm confident it's not going to be good.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's going to be one of those where, like, there are so many famous people in it, you're like, you're definitely covering up for the lack of, you know, quality in this film. Yeah. Cate Blanchett won Best Actress in Drama for Tar as the main character there. She was up against Olivia Colman, Viola Davis, Ana de Armas, and Michelle Williams.
What was Ana de Armas nominated for?
Blonde.
Oh, okay.
Which I've not seen.
Me neither. Apparently it's terrible.
Yeah, I've heard quite a lot of contentious things about that film. You were asking Michelle Yeoh. She was up against Leslie Manville for Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, Margot Robbie in Babylon, Anya Taylor-Joy in The Menu, and Emma Thompson in Good Luck to You, Leo Grand.
Okay. I'm happy with that.
And then Colin Farrell was up against Diego Calva for Babylon, Daniel Craig, again, Glass Onion, Adam Driver in White Noise, and Ralph Fiennes in the, or Ralph Fiennes, I think his name, for The Menu.
White Noise, what's that?
It's on Netflix. I've not seen it, but it's a film by Noah Baumbach, I believe.
Okay.
Best Supporting Actor, which seems to just be its own category rather than being drama and comedy. Kei Huy Quan for Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Love that.
He was up against people like Brendan Gleeson, Barry Keoghan, Brad Pitt, and Eddie Redmayne. Angela Bassett won Best Supporting Actress for her portrayal of Queen Ramonda. She was up against Kerry Condon from The Banshees of Inisherin, Jamie Lee Curtis from Everything Everywhere All at Once, Dolly Leon for Triangle Sadness, and Kerry Mulligan for She Said. Spielberg won Best Director. So yeah, I mean, I don't know how much of an indication this is for the Oscars. There's a film that we will probably talk about in a minute where I think there's probably a good shout for Best Actress nomination. Don't know if you agree.
Yeah,
so that was the Golden Globes.
Just quickly, sorry, just wanted to talk about the TV winners.
Oh, yeah, I forgot they do TV.
Yeah.
I'm not a very good host, am I? Let me scroll down to... So, Best Drama TV Series was House of the Dragon.
How do you feel about it?
I mean, it was up against Better Call Saul, which I've not seen. The Crown, which I've not seen. Ozark, which I really liked, but the fourth season, or the final season, wasn't great. Well, not the best. Severance, I've not finished. I mean, I guess I'm surprised that Andor's not there.
Snubbed, mate. Snubbed.
The Golden Globes are fucking bullshit. Yeah, I mean, that's the, you know, kind of the only other real top show that I remember from last year. Obviously, huge caveat, I don't watch every TV series, so don't come up if you're a big fan of Better Call Saul. But yeah, was that what you were going to say with Returns to TV?
I was as well, and also I was looking at I was thinking, like, what did one, well, two-pronged thing. I was thinking, I wonder what they kind of look for when they say, like, best drama series kind of thing. Like, because there's, like, they got The Bear under musical or comedy, and I would say The Bear is more of a drama than anything. So I'm talking about, like, how they categorize it kind of thing.
Yeah, this is the thing with the Golden Globes, because they've got the drama and musical comedy, which I have no idea why they separate that as out into those two. I'm sure I said this last year. But it kind of seems to me like the studio can just pitch it into whichever one they want, because famously The Martian won for best musical or comedy, and it's neither. So, yeah, I mean, like we said with Austin Butler in Elvis, like they might have just gone, well, he's got a better chance of winning in that category than this category.
Yeah.
So it kind of, you know, makes a bit of a mockery of it. I mean, the few episodes I've seen of Severance, like, there's like a dark comedy to it, I guess. And the two episodes I saw of The Bear were hella stressful.
Oh, mate, The Bear's great.
God, I find it so difficult to get through each episode.
I'm not like... It's so tense.
Yeah, but I'm not getting to the end of the episode like, I need to watch the next one. I'm like, I need a break.
Fair enough. I'm literally the opposite. I was like, watching, oh shit, like, I don't know what they, like, how they get through this kind of thing, what happens next. I watched that in like maybe 2 days. I finished that.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know it's not very long, so I do need to see it. I've started watching something on Disney Plus called The Patient. It's got Steve Carell in.
Oh, I've heard good things about it.
Yeah, I'm two episodes into that. It's like a drama, although for the Golden Globes purposes, it's a musical. And Steve Carell's kind of playing kind of like a serious role. And each episode's like 22 minutes, so it's really, you know, super easy to kind of fit in and around stuff, which is great because not every show has to be an hour long.
Yeah. Quick question, if you indulge me. Do you think that comedy is like the hardest genre to pull off?
You'll have to repeat the question. Sorry, it cut out.
Sorry. Do you think comedy is the hardest genre to pull off?
Do I think comedy is the hardest genre to pull off?
Yeah.
I think it's probably the hardest thing to write. I don't know, it's weird because if you've got a really funny script, then if someone's not particularly good at delivering it, it could either still be really funny or it could just fall flat. And then the opposite could be true. You could have a really terrible script, but if someone is like naturally quite funny, like Seth Rogen, then, you know, he could pretty much make anything sound funny. So I really don't know how to answer that question. I think it probably is one of the more difficult genres in general, because comedy is so, it can be cultural, it can be very personal as well, like what someone finds funny versus what, you know, someone else finds funny. So in terms of like a broad appeal, probably is quite difficult. Yeah. Do you think it is?
I do think it is, actually. Probably because people find different things funny. And like, the reason I was thinking about it was because Steve Carell, being in The Patient, obviously he's like, was known for being more of a comedic actor with like The Office and stuff like that. And I was thinking more about like these comedic actors who've like made the switch into more dramatic things, like him, Adam Sandler, a couple of others as well. And I was just wondering, like, I wonder what they find easier.
Yeah, I think it's difficult. So I'm not looking at Steve Carell in this show and laughing because it the tone of it, I don't know, I'm like more believing him in the serious role. But Adam Sandler, I've never been able to truly, you know, not think that what he's saying is about to be some sort of joke.
Mm.
Particularly like Uncut Gems and what was the other one he was in? That was a cultural moment.
That was.
But yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And also, you know, some drama actors are not necessarily great at their kind of comedy chops. So it's probably, yeah, probably is. I'm trying to think of another genre that would be quite as difficult to hit the masses. Mm. Because things like thrillers are probably going to be tense in any language or format. Same with drama, horror, doesn't really need to be. Yeah, I think you're right. If anyone listening has any other genre suggestions to throw into the bag, then do tweet us at YSCPodcast17 or better off, drop us a DM on Instagram where we are Your Average Critics. But within comedy, like, is it comedy in general? Do you think like rom-com or I don't know?
I was thinking more. I think in more general comedy, like what's it called? Kind of like, you know, like your Seth Rogen, that type of flow, rather than a rom com. I feel like rom coms aren't that hard to pull off.
No, they're also generally not that funny.
True.
Yeah, we need to put the com back into rom com.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good question. So we look forward with bated breath to the 81st Golden Globes next year. But anyway, on to someone who may be in contention for the Oscars, which, you know, have slightly more cachet to them, but still are not the be-all and end-all. I'm talking about the film Till, which is a biographical drama based on the life and death of Emmett Till, who, you know, a lot of us in the UK learned about in history, and the kind of fight that his mother, Mammy, kind of took to get justice for her son after he was lynched by some racists in the South. It's directed by Chinonye Chukwu, who also did a film called Clemency, which I've not seen. But it stars Danielle Deadwyler, who I think, based on her performance in here, could well be at least in the running for a Best Actress nomination. So, yeah, I mean, I thought this film, I was worried about this film. I think I might have said it on the pod before, particularly after I saw Emancipation. I was, because this is a incredibly horrific story about Emmett Till and kind of the violence that was he was subject to. And I thought, I was worried that it would be not glorified, but it would be gratuitous and there would be like a unnecessary amount of focus on the pain that he received. But thankfully, it doesn't. It does show, you know, the aftermath once he's in his coffin. But Mammy obviously wanted the world to see that. Hence the famous photos that have been shown of his kind of beaten face. So I guess that's the reason why the film, you know, thought it was appropriate to show that. And it is shocking, and it should be. But yeah, I mean, the first kind of 20 minutes, half an hour is of Mammy and Emmett together. And, you know, he's looking forward to going from Chicago to visit his cousins in Mississippi. I think Jalen Hall, who plays Emmett Till, is like a really kind of charismatic actor and really brought a lot of like life to that. And then, you know, he whistles at a white woman and is, you know, unfortunately brutalized by some locals because of that. And then the rest of the film is basically the aftermath, Mammy trying to get justice with the help of the NAACP, and kind of get his attackers, Emmett's attackers, to kind of be in prison, which unfortunately is unsuccessful. Although I guess sadly not surprising for the time, which was 1955. So yeah, I think she Danielle Deadwyler was captured, like the pain, you know, the particular scenes of her kind of breaking down and kind of the distraught like nature, the feelings that she felt real to me. It didn't feel like over the top or melodramatic. And then there's also kind of in the court scenes, her kind of like stoic, like face is, you know, particularly when the woman who was whistled at, Carolyn, was just lying about what happened. Mammy had to obviously be reserved because, you know, she was not on a level playing field. So I thought her performance was great. And the film was powerful in the right ways, and it was respectful in the right ways, and kind of shocking in also the right ways, if that makes sense. So yeah, I was, you know, quite impressed with it. What did you think?
I'm right there with you, to be fair. It's hard to say that you enjoyed the film because of the subject matter. But I think the film is good. The film's well done. Like you say, the actress who played Mamie Till was really, really good. I believed her, kind of like not... I kind of thought that the way that she kind of like took on the role of being that kind of like having to grieve for your son, but also kind of realizing that you want his kind of death to mean more, and like to be able to kind of like use that to show people that, you know, this is what's going on in life, and this is why, you know, we need to kind of like rise up against these sorts of things. And I think kind of like they did a good job to kind of show that like his death kind of like wasn't meaningless, like it did help kind of like push on a movement. I think as well they kind of did quite well to kind of show how like, I suppose, certain members of like that the NAACP community, they kind of, it obviously they were sympathetic, but it also kind of was like, think, okay, this is obviously tragic, but we can also use this as an opportunity to kind of like further, I wouldn't say our agenda because that makes it sound negative, but kind of like further our fight for, you know, civil rights. So I think they did well to kind of show that also kind of maybe more callous side of it, where it's like, we need to kind of like use this to our advantage. It sounds weird to say that, but you know, that's kind of how it felt watching it. I think that actually one thing I enjoyed as well was that, the music, like the soundtrack, I think was not soundtrack, sorry, the score was, it kind of always gave this sense of, and I think actually Daniel Deadwyler did well with this as well. Actually, it kind of always gave that sense of like, even though, especially like before Emmett Till dies, kind of like, oh, this might be a happy moment and stuff like that, but there is this impending, like, I wouldn't say doom, but obviously, you know, there is something, you always kind of, the music kind of always gave that feeling that there was something about to happen kind of thing. And Daniel Deadwyler as well, kind of like in her face, like to her son, she'd be like smiling and happy, but then, you know, she turns away from the camera and you see in her face, actually, she's worried to death about her son kind of thing. I think the music's done well to capture that feeling as well. So you always feel pretty uneasy up until like the point where Emmett Till was murdered. I thought it's a really good film. It makes me upset, I'm not gonna lie. When the film's finished, I was angry. I was like, this kind of just like, it's upsetting, to be honest. And I think, I suppose that's the point of it. I suppose you're supposed to be kind of like enraged by kind of like how the film plays out, because obviously that's real life. You know?
I think the most enraging thing was when in the kind of postscript it said it wasn't until 2021 or 2022 that the Emmett Till anti-lynching bill came into law in
the state. 2022, yeah.
Which was like 67 years after it happened. And you're like, what? Was lynching legal up until that point?
Mm.
Which just, I mean, you know, you think, right, the civil rights movement has happened and great. But, I mean, still, for that to have happened in 2022, I'm not saying the UK is, you know, perfect. But that to happen in the States, it just makes you think, geez, it's still ongoing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's crazy. And, like, as well, like, I think it's a bit mental, like, that, obviously, I know double jeopardy is a thing and all that stuff, but it's mental that, like, you can get, you know, tried for a crime, you're proven not guilty, then you can go and say, actually, I did it, but they can't retry you again.
Yeah, and then they got, that's nuts. Was it £4,000 for the interview, didn't they?
Yeah.
I mean, that's ridiculous.
That's crazy. But... you know, that's the judicial system, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, your point about the score and the kind of foreboding that it kind of gives, I wasn't sure how I felt about that, because part of me was thinking, was the director basically saying, like, to the audience, you know what's going to happen, and so that's what it's about. But I also felt that, like, Mammy wouldn't have been like that. Even if she was constantly worried, there were definitely elements where it was sort of like, she kind of knew what was going to happen. Mm. Particularly the first shot where they're in the car. And it was like cutting between her driving and then Emmett in the passenger seat. And then I'm sure, like, when it went back to her, the colour was slightly different. And I was thinking, is she actually on her own and just thinking about a time that she was driving with Emmett? Mm. Yeah, it was always very much like, knowing that, oh, you know what's going to happen to this character. Well, not even our character, is it this person? So yeah, I was a bit like, I don't know. It kind of felt a bit fantastical in a way of like, maybe already knew what was going to happen. But, you know, that didn't detract that much from the film for me.
No, I get that. But yeah, generally, it's a good film. And I think, like you said earlier, they did a good job to kind of, I suppose, make it a bit more informative and less like exploitative, like in terms of like not showing kind of like the actual the murder happening. So yeah, I am curious like how many more of these types of films we will get. And kind of when do we get to the point where we kind of steer away from these things kind of thing? Because, like, obviously I'm all for kind of like education through any medium, really, through film especially, because obviously I love films. But it does get to a point where I'm like, I'm actually sick of seeing these types of things, because it's upsetting. Like, I left the cinema upset. Like, you know, I want to see happier stories, but, you know, I suppose you have to kind of, I'm thinking of it from the maybe the writers or producing side of it. This is probably the stuff that, you know, people get people in their seats, I guess. I don't know.
It's kind of that callousness, isn't it? It's like you are profiting off of this pain, and, you know, certain films do it to a more or less exploitative extent. But I came out of that and Emancipation, and I was like, I probably would have been more educated having watched a documentary. I don't understand. It's tough because, you know, you want these stories to be told, and the way it's going to probably get to more people is through, you know, a theatrical kind of retelling. But it also, like, you know, it is a bit contentious.
Yeah.
I'm not aware of a kind of big budget kind of Rosa Parks film, so I imagine that's definitely going to be something that happens before these films, you know, are confined to history themselves. But yeah, I mean, we've had Martin Luther King, we've had Mandela, we've had Malcolm X, we've had Emmett Till. Yeah, I think maybe Rosa Parks is maybe the next.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, good film, but obviously we need, it's important for us to mention how it makes us and particularly you feel. So yeah.
So you think she'll get an Oscar nom?
I think she should. I mean, I'm not quite sure who else is going to be in the running. I don't know. Again, like I said, I don't know if the Golden Globe's going to be anything to go by. The Fabelman seems to be getting quite decent reviews critically. I'm not necessarily sure it's doing that well theatrically. Well, I mean, Olivia Colman was nominated in the Golden Globes. Do you want to give us a review of Empire of Light?
I will do. Anybody who wants a short review of Empire of Light, you can go to Your Average Critics on Instagram, where I did like a little mini video in my car.
Hashtag face reveal.
Hashtag face reveal. I'm in my mum's car. I was on that video for time. Anyway, yeah, Empire of Light is a film by Sam Mendes, who I think he wrote and directed it, and he did 1917, I think, and not Skyfall.
Was it Spectre?
Spectre, that's it, thank you.
He did Skyfall and Spectre.
Oh, did he? Okay, well, there you go. So yeah, it's a film about a woman played by Olivia Colman who, again, do you care if I spoil it? Or?
No, I don't think I'm going to get an opportunity to see it.
Okay, cool. It's a film by film about a woman who is has been suffering from like mental health issues. And has just kind of like been coming back from like the a mental health institution, and she works at a cinema, and there's kind of like this lingering feeling, I suppose, that she's kind of like not really been the same since she kind of like had this like mental breakdown, but she's like back working in cinema now, where she's kind of like assistant manager basically, but she doesn't speak very much anymore. She doesn't really have any friends or family. She like has like Christmas dinner by herself and stuff like that. And she has a manager who exploits her sexually, I suppose. Played by Colin Firth.
Okay. Can you expect Colin Firth to play someone who sexually exploits someone?
Yeah. Well, can I call it exploitation? I suppose I can. Because it's a high, because he's a manager kind of thing, isn't it? Right?
What does he kind of like pressurize her into?
Well, it's not that he'll, wherever we see them, him pressurizing her, we see him be like, she says like they'll have be having like a staff meeting, he'll be like, oh, so I can't remember her name, so and so, can I see in my office? And then it cuts to them and I think they're fucking basically, and he's like, oh yeah, like, to be fair, he says like, oh yeah, suck me off. He's like, he'll call him out saying suck me off, it's very funny. He's
like, oh jeez.
He's like, yeah, he's like, can you suck me off? And she's like, no. And to be fair, he says, okay, cool. He like respects that. Like, he doesn't force her into anything.
So I guess there's a power imbalance.
Yeah, it? that's more what I was getting to, yeah, the power thing aspect of it. Yeah, so that's going on. And then at the cinema, they hire a new guy played by Michael Ward. I think his name's Stephen. And for like maybe 8 minutes of this film, Michael Ward has a very strange accent where it's kind of like, not posh, but it's like, I don't know, it's like halfway between like West London and like Surrey. It's a really strange accent.
Okay.
Only for like two, three conversations, and then he just goes back to like speaking more normally, I suppose. It's very strange. So yeah, he's a new guy, he's like charismatic and da, da, da. It's set in the '80s, by the way, I believe. 1980, I think it's set in. And he kind of like is like a bit flirty with like some of the other staff members. Olivia Colman's character like notices him and stuff like that. But she's like, oh, he's just like funny and stuff like that. But then he's kind of like take a liking to her. And then they just like, they take care of, like they go to the top of the cinema, which is like abandoned, like nobody goes there. And they find like this baby bird, and they like, he like nurses the baby bird back to his health because his mum's a nurse. And then she, I guess, that endears him to her, I guess. And then it like kind of skips on to like New Year's. They have like a New Year's thing. They like watch, those two watching the fireworks together. She kisses him and then says, oh shit, and he runs away. And then he's like, oh no, it's fine, it's fine. A couple bit more time, couple more things move on. They get closer and closer as kind of like the weeks go on, I guess. And eventually they like get into like this secret relationship. And the film's kind of like centered on that, like they're having that, this relationship and them hiding it. And also how having this relationship affects Olivia Colman's character. She gets more confident. She's more talkative and stuff, a bit more vibrant, wears a bit more vibrant clothes and stuff. But also she, key thing, she stops taking her medication for, I think she might be bipolar. No, sure, schizophrenic is what Colin Firth says, but I don't know if he was being insulting when he said it, but some sort of mental health issue. She stops taking her medication. And at first it doesn't raise any alarm bells, but then she starts having like these mood swings and like going off on Michael Ward's character and stuff like that. And he doesn't really think anything about it. Strangely so. I suppose maybe he thinks that it's just women. So yeah, they have their relationship. Meanwhile, you've also got another side of the film where it's like racism and like it's the National Front and these immigrants are coming and taking our jobs and blah, blah, blah. It's 1980. So then, yeah, there's that side of it. And there's these people who are like super aggressive towards Michael Ward and stuff like that. You've got that side of it. And the third side of it is like, can you have three sides? I don't know. Third side of it.
Triangles do.
Thank you. Is like this other character, I think played by Toby Jones, I want to say, is his name?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like the film aficionado, and he's kind of like teaching Michael Ward's character like the magic of cinema and like how, you know, your eyes have like this glitch in them that like allows you to see frames at 24 frames per second and blah, blah, blah. And that's like all the light contributes to like how, like changing the fucking, what's it called, the film and all stuff like that. You have to do it all on time. It's all like magical, all works together and blah, blah, blah. And like, you know, there's that side of it, I guess. And then Olivia Colman's character's never watches films. Like, she's never watched a film in that cinema and stuff like that. And then, yeah, and then some shit happens.
I can hear your enthusiasm for this waning. The longer you talk about it.
Yeah, so long story short, even I've been waffling for a minute. Olivia Colman's character's mental health continues to deteriorate. Then you've got, there is like a premiere at the cinema. They're working out, I think it's somewhere in Kent. I want to say like Margate or something like that. At which point they invite like the mayor. The mayor comes, Michael Ward and Olivia Colman, they get caught, like the relationship. Someone, like one of the other workers knows about it. So Michael Ward's like, oh, let's call it off. She gets upset, goes into like a spiral, makes a speech at the premiere that she wasn't supposed to make. But it's about like equality and kind of like, oh, black and white, we should all work together. Blah, blah. So there's that, speech, but she was like off a rocker at this point. So it's like, you know, respectfully, she was off a rocker. So yeah, it was a bit like a bit wayward. And then, yeah, she then meets Colin Firth's wife and is like, yeah, I've been fucking your husband, da, 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 da. Then she goes into a bigger spiral. Police have to come around the door, bash her door in to take her back to the hospital. Michael Ward's there and he's like, oh, I'm really sorry, da, 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 blah, blah, blah. And then he, for some reason, Michael Ward gets back together with his ex-girlfriend, who's like in it for like two scenes. And then after that, he gets back with Olivia Colman. And then he goes off to uni. And
how young is he?
He's supposed to be like 21, I think, or 20.
Okay.
In real life, I think he's like maybe 25. And yeah, he goes off to uni and she's like really upset about it, blah, 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 blah. And then, yeah, then she goes to the cinema and sees a film for like, I don't know, maybe the first time in her life, I don't know. And it's like supposed to be magical and all that shit. And then, yeah, the film ends.
Doesn't sound like you bought any of it.
No, I did not. It doesn't really know what it wants to be, the film. It could have been like a rom-com-y, it could have been like a love story. It's not quite that. Could have been a story about like mental health. Not quite that. Could have been a story about like social issues. Not quite that. Could have been a story about the magic of cinema. It's not quite that either. It was a bit of a mess in my personal unprofessional opinion. I don't think that the thing that I think is supposed to kind of hold this film together is like the chemistry between the two leads. Like I should believe them together. I should want them to be together. I didn't believe them, nor did I want them to be together, nor did I think that relationship was good for either of them.
Would not have suggested Michael Ward and Olivia Colman for like an age gap relationship, but hey.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like I was wondering to myself, am I thinking this way? There was a part of me that thought to myself, oh, do I only think this because it's like, I don't know, an older woman and a younger man kind of thing? Like, is my brain engineered to think that like there's something wrong with that kind of thing? But then I just thought, nah, they just don't have any chemistry. So yeah, it's not bad. Like, it's not a terrible film. It's just very jumbled, I think, and it doesn't really have any sense of direction. And it kind of just like ends. He goes to uni and the film ends, and I was like, oh, all right, sure. Not worth writing home about, which is a shame because I both like Michael Ward and I like Olivia Colman. So I wish the film was better. But unfortunately, it's very, very painfully average, I would say, / not very good.
Well, that's a shame. She's been, she was nominated for Best Actress in the Golden Globes, and Michael Ward has been nominated for a BAFTA for Best Supporting Actor.
Good for
him. Either of those merited?
Not in my opinion, no, to be honest. So when I think of like Olivia Colman, in terms of like, to be fair, I haven't seen her in loads of stuff. I've seen her in probably a handful of films, but I was thinking of her in like The Father. Like to me, that was
Yeah. Like, or even The Favourite, she was good in The Favourite.
Yeah, in The Favourite as well, exactly. Yeah, I thought she was great in both of those. To be fair, in this she's good, but I don't know. I just didn't get the feeling like, oh yeah, this is Oscar worthy or this is gold, this is award worthy. And Michael Ward, I actually think he's better than the performance that he gave. And it might be the script wasn't good. But when like there were certain moments and I was just like, I don't believe you. And it's funny because like in this, he plays a character, obviously in that set in the 80s. And I don't know if you remember watching those Small Axe stories on BBC.
I watched one or two of those.
Yeah. And he was in one of those. I think he was playing a character in the 60s, I think. And I found him so much more believable in that role than in this role. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was the way it was written, but I don't know. I just thought it was. I just didn't think he was great, and I'm surprised. To be honest, I'm surprised he got nominated, but I'm happy for him. Hope he wins. But you know.
Yeah. I'm not going to go through all the BAFTAs ones, but he is up against Brendan Gleeson, Perry Keegan. I think that's how you say it. Anyway, Keegan or.
I think it's Keegan. Yeah.
Yeah. Kei Hee Huan, Eddie Redmayne and Albrecht Schuh from All Quiet on the Western Front. So I think he's maybe not the front runner for that. Someone who doesn't appear to have yet received a nomination for Best Supporting Actress, but I think she probably should, is a young actress called Frankie Corio, who plays Sophie in the film After Sun, which I saw the other day. It's a kind of like father-daughter, I guess it's like coming of age, if you could have that for like a father-daughter relationship. So she's on holiday with her father in Turkey. Her father's played by Paul Mescal, who I believe has been cast in the sequel to Gladiator.
Gladiator?
Yeah. Wow. That's going to be a thing. Yeah. His name is Maximus Meridius, whatever. He also got critical acclaim for his role in the TV show Normal People. So Callum and Sophie, father-daughter, go to Turkey. It's she's just turned 11 and he's about to turn 31. And essentially it's like a series of almost like vignettes of what they get up to on their holiday. It's quite slow paced and ponderous almost, but it works. So, you know, you see them kind of, it starts out with like a, she's got a camcorder because this is like the '90s. And, she kind of says to her father, like, I've just turned 11. When you were 11, what did you think you'd be doing when you were 30? And he kind of looks a bit sad and says, oh, turn the camera off. And then you kind of see different parts of their holiday. And I don't think it's necessarily what you see is necessarily in chronological order. It's quite difficult to tell sometimes, but you know, they go on a boat trip, she loses a mask, like her scuba mask, and she's like, oh, I'm really sorry, I know that's expensive. He seems to have like difficulty in his job. There's a point where he's talking about, oh, why don't you get this little trinket you want, and she goes, Dad, you don't need to pretend that you can afford it or something. And so she's like quite precocious, but they have like a good relationship. But there are elements of this that where it's a bit strained, like he's maybe feeling his age, even though 31 is not that old, considering we'll be that soon. And she's just turned 11. So she's in this weird like liminal phase of being too old for certain kid activities. But there aren't, like, she doesn't want to hang out with. So her father's always going, oh, why don't you go and introduce yourself to those girls? But they look maybe like 8 or 9. And she's like, well, no, they're too young. But then the people that she wants to hang out with are 16, 17.
Yeah.
And whilst they kind of tolerate her, she obviously can't partake in the activities that they do. So she's kind of wanting to be more adult. She has her first kiss on this holiday. But yeah, so she tries to get closer to her father, who's pulling away, seems melancholy. He seems to have some sort of depression. And
sorry, what's happened to the mum in this scenario?
They just divorced.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, so it's just like he's taking her away. And then it also cuts to what I presume is like the present day of an adult Sophie. And she's in a club. And like the lights are really flashing. You can catch glimpses of her father in the club, but he's the same age that he is in the 90s. So, I mean, I don't know if you're going to watch this film, so I don't want to necessarily spoil it, but...
I might actually, because I saw a little trailer for it, and actually thought it looked pretty good.
Yeah, okay, well, I won't really say much more, but it's... When I was watching it, I was like, this is quite a bit long, a bit ponderous. I mean, it's about 90 minutes, but it feels a bit longer. Mm. But when it ends, and you kind of reflect on it, it works, and it's quite a it's a really kind of like tender and nice portrayal of a father-daughter relationship, and she is brilliant in it. And I guess the thing with child actors is you don't know whether they're actually acting or if they just are the way they are, but I still like fully believed her in that role as Sophie. And you know, Paul Mescal's good, but Frankie Corio's definitely got a lot more to do, so I would thoroughly recommend it. It's a very, yeah, kind of cute portrayal of a father-daughter relationship.
That sounds promising. I think, when did that come out? Is it out properly? Is it out like properly yet?
Yeah, so where my local cinema, it only is being shown once a week. It's also been released on a platform called Mubi.
I've never heard of that in my life.
Yeah, another service. Yeah, so it's either on Mubi, M-U-B-I, or it's playing every Monday at my local Odeon. Right. I don't know about you. But yeah, definitely check it out if you can, in whatever format you can. Yeah. But yeah, I'm surprised that she's not got a nomination for, you know, at least the BAFTAs, which, you know, tend to recognise British performances. Before we talk about the big hit HBO TV show, that is filling the gap currently that House of Dragons left. I wanted to talk about Megan, which, yeah, I'm sure you've seen the trailers, right?
Yeah, it's, the marketing campaign was fantastic.
It was elite. Like, you know, for, to freshen up the Oscars, let's have a best marketing campaign. Let's have a best stunt performance or something like that. But yeah, this film is 99% marketing, which is absolutely fine because it has worked an absolute treat for the studio, produced by Blumhouse, who, you know, have done everything from the Purge films. They've done reboots of like The Grudge. They are everywhere. If it's horror, they've probably done it. They've also done things like Whiplash and Black Klansman. So yeah, kind of independent. But this was distributed by Universal. But yeah, budget of 12 million, it's already made over 100. So
has it really?
Yeah.
That's so impressive. Wow.
Yeah. The memification. If I was at uni, still doing my film degree, I would be writing about the memification of Megan. So yeah, if you haven't seen the trailers or don't know anything about this film, it's essentially about a young girl called Katie who goes to live with her aunt after her she's orphaned. Her aunt is like a product developer for a toy company, and she's been trying to develop this android like robot, a like kind of life-sized of a 8 or 9 year old, called Megan, model 3 generative android, and you know, giving it artificial intelligence. She's trying to pitch it to her boss, played by Ronnie Cheng, he's quite funny. If you've never seen him, he's a stand-up. And to help pitch it, she kind of gets Katie to pair with Megan, and they form like quite a close bond. And Gemma, the aunt, says to Megan, "Your primary function is to protect Katie from harm." And that gets taken to the nth degree, shall we say. Are you going to watch this film?
Do you know what? I was going to, and I might, and but I'm not as bothered about watching it now because I've heard that it's not that great. But go ahead and spoil it. I might still watch it anyway, but go ahead
and talk about what you want. Well, to be honest, you can tell where this is going, like, almost straight away. Like, it's pretty derivative. It's quite a, you know, paint by numbers plot in a sense. Like, it's a killer doll film, you know, a la Chucky or Annabelle. It's a AI gone wrong film, a la iRobot. And yeah, I mean, you know, the AI goes wrong and she starts killing people to protect Katie. So yeah, no surprises there. And to be honest, it doesn't really develop much beyond the trailer, which is a shame considering the trailer is like 3 minutes long and this film is an hour and 45. But the stuff that kind of pads it out just is not that interesting. The main beats are in the trailer, particularly that, like, the memeified dance bit where Megan like sways a bit, does like a cartwheel, and then picks up a knife and, you know, chases after the boss. So yeah, I mean, it's not great. Doesn't advance particularly any of the kind of subgenres that it's going for. It's quite it's like a kind of campy horror. I mean, horror is also a very loose term.
Is it funny?
I think I laughed once.
Okay.
There's like elements of satire it's trying to do, which is kind of, it's fine, but it's not like super hilarious. It's also not scary in any way. And the kind of uncanny valley of Megan wears off pretty quickly. you look at it and you go, actually, you really don't look like a human. And it also just looks a bit shit eventually. So, yeah, it's absolutely fine. It's unfortunately doesn't develop anything beyond the trailer. It's also in this weird, annoying state where it's too adult to be a 12, according to the BBFC, but it's also way too soft to actually be a 15. So it's a PG-13 in America, which, you know, if there was a 13 and a half age rating, this would probably sit quite neatly into that. It kind of is restrained in its kind of depiction of, you know, the violence.
How many deaths are there, roughly?
There's kind of 1, 2, there's like 3 that you see,
okay,
and then there's 2 that are heavily implied.
Okay.
But even the ones you see, there's not a lot of detail.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I also guess the ending, literally within about 10 minutes.
Well,
as soon as Katie goes to her Aunt Gemma's house, I knew what was going to happen at the end. So yeah, it doesn't do anything new, but like I said, it's done very, very well. And
does it leave itself open for a sequel? Because apparently it's getting a sequel.
Obi, what do you think?
I can take it as a yes.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I mean, look, am I going to see it? Probably. But am I going to have any expectations? No.
Yeah.
Am I going to continue to answer my own questions? Yes. So, you know, if it ever gets a third one, I don't know how they're going to title it, because the title already has M3GAN. So. Yeah. But that's Megan. Maybe wait for it to come on streaming. But
yeah, sounds like one of them ones, to be fair.
Yeah. I mean, I think I gave it like a 6. It's a bang average film. But yeah, anyway, they're making money. So, is there any films that you want to talk about before we move on to The Last of Us, Obi?
I will quickly just say that I've been watching the Batman films from the 90s.
Oh, wow. Okay.
1989 to the up to the 90s. Those films are bad, mate. Like, they're not good.
which ones are particularly bad?
So I actually think, so it's so funny, because obviously people, I think, have pointed to like Batman Forever and Batman and Robin as being particularly like really shit. And granted, they are shit, but in my eyes, they're all on. So Batman 89, Batman Returns, Batman Forever, Batman Robin, in my eyes, are all on pretty much the same level of shitness. Like, Michael Keaton is a terrible Batman / Bruce Wayne. The fight scenes are crap, even for that time. Arnold Schwarzenegger plays Mr. Freeze, or Dr. Freeze, or one of them, in Batman and Robin, and at least he was funny, because his lines were so stupid, because every line was a pun about like cold off ice.
Right. Okay.
So, and it was funny. So, like, they played up to the campiness and, like, the cartoony element of it, which I enjoyed, because I knew what they were kind of trying to do with it. The films that preceded it tried to be so much more serious, but they just come off looking so shit and, like, not really making sense. Yeah, those films are not good. And, yeah, I reiterate again, Michael Keaton, even just as a look, he does not look or act like I think Bruce Wayne would look or act. Val Kilmer, much better. George Clooney, absolutely not. But yeah.
What makes a good Batman for you then? Or what makes a good Batman / Bruce Wayne? Because you've also like recently had Robert Pattinson, who is young, quite slim and tall. You've had Ben Affleck, who is, you know, muscular, looks quite like, I guess, jockish. And then you've got Christian Bale, who's kind of in the middle. So, yeah.
So I would say, looks wise, I would go more for the Christian Bale slash Val Kilmer in his, so like Bruce Wayne, mid-ish brown hair, like a little sweep over brown hair kind of thing. Like Michael Keaton's got like this, his hair's like proper like fluff, was proper fluffy in the 80s. It looks so weird. Like that kind of comb over sort of hair. In terms of attitude, I would say the Bruce Wayne side of it, more cocky, in the outside world, more of like a playboy, that type of, I think Christian Bale in Batman Begins and the Dark Knight has it down to a T, I think. And even Ben Affleck, actually, I would say, like in certain parts of Batman v Superman, I think he has this persona that he has to put out to the world, but obviously we all know that in his mind he's like the smartest person in the room. I think they play that really well, whereas the other ones don't do it so much. In terms of Batman, so the voice, for a start, I think it was, to be fair, apparently it was Michael Keaton who first developed the whole changing your voice as when you're Batman to your Bruce Wayne. Which, fair play to him. I mean, I suppose that's smart, I guess, and that kind of like has lent itself to Batman over the ages. But I remember thinking, because I watched, so Batman and Robin, George Clooney, obviously, George Clooney puts on the exact same voice in both Batman and Bruce Wayne. I'm like, you're talking to people who you've spoken to as Bruce Wayne. Like, they would know it's you. They would know what your voice sounds like. Like, Glenn, if you put on a mask and started talking to me, like, I would know that you're Batman.
Yeah, fair.
I think, actually, what's his face? Christian Bale, his Batman voice, is actually not very good. Because he kind of, if you watch the film again, he kind of does it. And his voice sounds like, it sounds like when he's wearing the mask is like suffocating him a bit, and it sounds like quite claustrophobic. Like he's like, his nose is clogged. It's weird, which is weird. I think Ben Affleck probably has the best Batman voice. And in terms of like Batman's demeanor, like just, you know, this is where I think like, obviously Christian Bale, Ben Affleck, Robert Pattinson, I think, and this is obviously to do with writing as well. I think they make Batman, you know, smart, like especially in the Batman, he's like a detective and he's smart, and like, in the Nolan films, he's like the smartest person in the room and he always knows like what he's doing kind of thing. And in those 90s films, they make Batman so stupid. Like, it's quite annoying to watch, to be honest. I mean, in the end, by the time I got to Batman Forever, I was like, okay, these films are just going to be shit. So like, I can, you know, get used to it, but blimey, they are not good.
Yeah, I guess there wasn't a trend back then for them to be super serious with DC. Although I think, you know, the Tim Burton Batman, there was an element of darkness to that.
There is Tim definitely Burton,
but it's also a little bit like the Joker makeup is not good.
Yeah, it borders on ridiculous. And even like in Batman Returns, the whole Catwoman element of it, I was like, this doesn't even make sense. Like, and I watched Catwoman today, actually. That film is a stinker. Goodness gracious.
Wow, you've been really putting yourself through the ringer.
Yeah.
I wanted to watch more films in 2023, but maybe start like with some decent ones. I don't know.
Yeah, to be fair, I kind of just wanted to, just because I think majority of them, I've seen Batman 1989 once. But the rest of them I hadn't seen. I actually never seen before, and I just heard that they weren't good. So I just wanted to kind of like see it for myself, sort of thing. And yeah, everybody was right; they're not good.
Well, yeah, general consensus wins through again.
Yeah, but that's pretty much all I've been watching, film-wise.
Fair enough. I'm sure I have watched another film in between, but I can't remember what it was. So it can't have been that good. But yeah, like I said, I've been watching The Patient and enjoying that. What else have I been watching? There's a film, a series on Apple TV called Servant, which has got Rupert Grint in.
Is that M. Night? That's one.
M. Night Shyamalan, yeah. So I'm a few episodes into that. There's a couple of series out, but I'm starting from the beginning. That's about like a well-to-do American couple in New York, and they recently suffered a loss of their baby, And so they got like a hyper realistic doll that the mother uses to kind of get over the kind of loss. And then they hire a nanny because the mother treats this doll literally as a real child. And so they hire a nanny who's like super young, super attractive, and, you know, immediately the kind of, well, Rupert Grint's the brother, and he says to the dad, like, oh, you know, is this your choice? And he's like, no, you know, this
the
is
brother of, the brother of who?
Of the woman, sorry.
Okay.
And I can't remember their names, so, but yeah, and so he's, and he's sort of like, where did you find this girl? And then they start looking into her, and she just has like no background, and then the doll comes to life.
All right.
It's a real baby. It's not like the doll comes to life, you know, like Megan or something. It's like, no, there was a doll, now there's a real baby. And yeah, so that's kind of like, did this new nanny steal a baby? Or like, what's happening? So it's yeah, a bit of like a suspense thriller. Again, these episodes are only like 25-30 minutes, so quite good. But I'm sure my subscription to Apple TV is going to expire soon, so after waiting until Will Smith gives me another one.
Didn't you get like a new phone recently?
Yeah, I already had my 3 months.
Did you? Oh shit!
I watched Ted Lasso.
Ah.
And then started watching Severance, and can't remember what else I started watching. But yeah, I mean, Apple TV's not like got enough on there for me to actively pay for it, so I'll just rely on free trials. On to The Last of Us. So this is a adaptation of the critically well received PlayStation game developed by Naughty Dog. So the first one was from 2013, and there's a second game in the series as well. I've never played the game, but what I gather, it's like post-apocalyptic, dare I say, zombies. I don't know if they refer to as zombies. But yeah, so this is an adaptation. It's on HBO, so you know the production values are going to be decent. It's on now, like Sky Atlantic or Now TV in the UK, developed by the same people who did Chernobyl, that show that came out last year or maybe the year before.
Oh, yeah.
That was pretty good. So this is starring two Game of Thrones alumni, Pedro Pascal, who is in The Mandalorian. He was also one of the Martells in Oberyn Martell in Game of Thrones. And Bella Ramsey is playing Ellie. She was Mormont.
Lady Mormont.
Lady Mormont in the later series. So essentially, there's a fungal infection that outbreaks and seems to, well, the suggestion is it turns people into zombies. So the first episode is out in the UK. It's the first only one that we've got. It was an hour and 20 minutes long. But it starts off in 1968 with a professor on like a American chat show, basically, you know, with other scientists, and they're kind of debating what the next pandemic will be, which is quite timely considering COVID. But yeah, so then, you know, one scientist is like, oh, it's going to be bacteria or viruses. And then John Hannah's character, Dr. Newman, he says, no, it's fungi, because, you know, they can take over your brain, and, you know, there's no cure for it. And, you know, the way that he was talking about it, I was like, oh God, I hope that's actually not based in truth, because
mate, it was quite a
convincing argument, wasn't it? From what he said. So I don't know if that's just really good writing or whatever, but yeah. So that happens right at the beginning, and then it cuts to 2003, I think it is, where Joel, who is Pedro Pascal's character, he and his daughter are, you know, basically, it's quite like A Quiet Place, in a sense that they are, you know, we see them right at the beginning of this pandemic. So their father, daughter, their neighbor gets infected, and then quite quickly there's like a shutdown of everything. So they're trying to get out of Texas, I think it is. And then they encounter some military who are basically like just killing people. They're like, nah, we can't let this thing spread. And they end up shooting and killing Joel's daughter, Sarah, who's played by Nico Parker, who is Tandy Wayne Newton's daughter. Which, you know, there is quite a resemblance. And then we cut to 20 years later, so that would make it 2023. And there's like a quarantine zone in Boston. Joel is working there, kind of doing odd jobs. He seems to kind of be a bit of a fixer, like he, in like a practical sense, but also in like a, hey, you need some pills, I've got pills for you. He is kind of together with someone called Tess, and they essentially, there seems to be some sort of politics going on with Fireflies versus the kind of FDA, or I think they're called, like the government versus the kind of rebels. And he doesn't seem to have any sort of allegiance at this moment in time. But in trying to find a car battery to go and find his brother Tommy, who we see in the earlier part of the episode, he comes across Ellie, played by Bella Ramsey, and like people that are protecting her. So she's 14 in the show, and we find out that she's been bitten by one of these zombies, but is resistant to the infection. So Joel and Tess are tasked with getting Ellie out of the quarantine zone and to some other people, presumably to take her somewhere else to get a vaccine. That's what we know so far. I thought it was good. I thought that the production values are decent. I mean, to me, it didn't really, kind of like with Megan, didn't really do anything to the genre differently to what I've seen before. Like, there was particularly the car chase scene where they're driving to try and get out of Texas, very much reminded me of A Quiet Place 2. And I mean, maybe that's from the game. I'm not sure. Maybe Quiet Place took it from the game.
I think it's like, yeah, directly from the game.
Oh, okay. Fair enough then. But yeah, so there's like elements of this that I can see in other things. You know, zombie, just general zombie kind of genre, whether it's The Walking Dead, 28 Days Later, you know, someone being the key to a vaccine is not something new either. So I'm kind of waiting for something to make this stand out from the rest of the genre. But so far, I mean, I enjoyed the first episode and I will watch the next one. What do you think? Am I being harsh?
I think, so I wouldn't say you're being harsh, but I would say that I am probably a bit more easily impressed than you are with the episode.
But I think everyone's more easily impressed than you.
But, mate, hard to please peers, mate, that's your nickname. But I think that's probably, for me, generally, it's because I'm, I probably have less, I suppose, viewing experience in this genre. So, like, I never watched The Walking Dead. I've not seen A Quiet Place. So I think this is probably a bit fresher for me than it is for you, who's kind of, like, probably exhausted that genre a bit more than most people. I think that the episode for me was really good. I really enjoyed it. I was gripped pretty much the entire time, especially the first, well, when they do the, like you say, that little bit in the beginning where they're talking about the fungal thing. I was like, it was so eerie because, like, he was like, the doctor was like explaining it and everyone was just silent. Everyone just like, no one knew what, like, there was no, I think it was like maybe like a bit scatters of laughter, but like even that made it even a bit more like tense. And even me, I was getting like tense, like, oh wow, like this could, maybe this could actually happen kind of thing. And then obviously, it flips to the start of it, start of the pandemic. And like, you just get these, like, And a bit similar to, I suppose, Till, like, you just get, obviously, that feeling that, like, okay, stop, it's about to happen soon. Like, you hear police sirens, you see police going this way, you see the woman saying, let's close the shop, you see, you hear airplanes going overhead, you're like, something's happening, we just, or the character Sarah, I suppose, because we're in her shoes, I suppose, at this point, we just don't know what it is yet. And, like, I think the actress who played Sarah was really good. I thought I found her really believable. Like, she's a good kid. Like, she, you know, she listens to school and she, like, she stole her dad's money, but she gave back the change. And then, and obviously, like, she can see that him and her and Pedro Pascal, I think the two had good chemistry for one. And also, like, you can tell that, like, there's love there, the relationship is there, but it's not, like, obviously it's not perfect, because he seems like he's a bit of, like, a, you know, maybe like a workaholic, not an absent father, but you say he's probably not, like, the most, like, attentive, I would say. And I wonder if we get any backstory on, like, the mum or the wife or anything like that. I'm curious to know about that. And yeah, obviously the pandemic stuff starts, and you've got, I thought the whole kind of, like, how they kind of, like, portrayed the old woman next door kind of, like, going mad and trying to bite her. And then, I don't know why, I love how, like, you get the phone call from the brother and he's like, oh yeah, this guy just started going mad on this girl, so I punch him in the face. I don't mean, something weird's going on, kind of thing. Obviously, no one says it explicitly. Then you get the scene with Sarah and the old woman. And then you don't see what's happened when he's gone to pick up his brother, but you just see them sprinting back, and he's like, get in the fucking car, because something shit's been going down. And I don't know why, I just like the way that was, like, shot, I suppose. Like, we didn't get to see it, but we know that, like, he's come out, he's got a wrench in his hand, like, he's ready to go, because, you know, it's all been kicking off at downtown at the prison or whatever. And then, yeah, I really enjoyed, like, the chase, the car scene as well, when they're trying to get out of Texas, was really good. As well, when they're, like, going forward, there's zombies there. Going backward, there's zombies there. Go forward again, they look back, there's a plane coming, and it smashes into the ground. I was like, fucking hell. Like, honestly, that, when the plane come and, like, smashed in front of them, I feel like I've had dreams like that, where I've, like, seen a plane, like, crashing in front of me, and, like, it makes, and, like, or nightmares, I suppose, because, like, I die. But yeah, and it just felt like that, and I was like, right, it's actually, like, feels properly intense. So yeah, really enjoyed that. And obviously, yeah, the bit with where they go up to the policeman guy. And I thought, the guy in the army, and before he shoots them. And because on his truck, Joel's truck, sorry, is his name, he had the army thing. So I thought he was going to be like, oh, no, I'm, like, former army. And I thought then he'd be like, oh, okay, cool, we'll let you go, kind of thing. But he just didn't say anything. And obviously, he was like, oh, yeah, sorry, and just fucking shot him. I was like, bro, that's a bit crazy.
Yeah, but, and it's mirrored later at the end of the episode, isn't it, when they get caught sneaking out of the quarantine zone, and rather than freezing, Joel isn't scared of being violent, which is interesting for our kind of protagonist.
Definitely. So yeah, that I think that first act, I suppose, was really, really gripping. And then obviously we skip to, like, present day, and the bit with, like, obviously the kid, he's, like, limping towards the quarantine, he faints, and then they scan him and he's red. And I was thinking, like, what does red mean? He's negative? Or, and then obviously she says, oh yeah, we're going to give you cheeseburger or whatever you want to eat. And they give him the needle. And I was thinking, like, I bet money they're going to kill him. And obviously the next scene, you see his fucking body. They just, do you know what it is? It's so funny, because I was thinking, like, surely they're not going to show us them burning children, because I feel like in TV there's, like, that line where they kind of, like, they don't really show you, like, killing children, kind of thing, or, like, not in that way. But obviously they kind of, like, said, fuck it, there he is, and he just unceremoniously chucks his body in the fire, and I was like, oh shit.
Yeah, it just shows that, like, you know, they're it's just matter of fact, isn't it? It's like, you're dead,
literally. And yeah, I think...
Who's making kids during this? Do you know what I mean?
I was thinking that. I was genuinely thinking that.
That was my always thing with The Walking Dead as well. It's like, why are you procreating?
I was thinking the same... Honestly, I thought the same thing. But I suppose people are going to fuck in it, because, you know...
but, you know, what? Durex stopped producing, I don't know.
Yeah, fair enough. I can't remember what it was. And I think I just like enjoying kind of like these little things about the present day. Like everyone's got like all the ration cards. You've got the man who's like in the building sending messages for everyone. You've got, you know, Joel, who's kind of like people fear kind of thing. You've got the other side, and you've got the rebellion. And for a minute, I thought that, what was the woman's name? Marlene?
Marlene, yeah.
I thought for a minute in some weird twist she was going to be Joel's daughter. For a second. Obviously, that's not the case. And I like Bella Ramsey. Is her name Bella Ramsey?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like Bella Ramsey in the role. I think she was really good as Lady Mormont, so I kind of was expecting her to be good. But she's strong. Her American accent is decent. Well, from my perspective, I don't really know. Obviously, I don't know the intricacies of the American accent, but she seems like it kind of reminds me of Logan. You had like Wolverine and X-23. I feel like their relationship's going to be a bit like that.
Because there's a point he says, I think this is in the trailer, but he says, like, your cargo.
Mm.
So, like, it's a job for him.
Mm.
A means to an end. But, yeah, I mean, I'm sure they'll end up developing some sort of, like, father-daughter kind of relationship.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd think so, anyway. That's at least what, like, conventional TV shows would do, storylines would try to achieve. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to kind of seeing how this whole thing plays out. Obviously, he's looking for his brother now. We don't really know he just kind of says that like the Firefly people turned his brother against him. We don't really know what that means. So I'm curious to see kind of like what's transpired there. And also, one thing I'm just thinking of generally is like obviously, what's her face, Ellie in this show. Is immune, I guess, to the virus. But like, what are they going to do with that? Because you'd think that if this person is immune, then everybody in the world would be like, oh yeah, cool, let's fucking, you know, let's protect this woman with our lives. So why are they being so secret?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, maybe there's something around. Maybe this was like a manufactured thing. We don't actually know where, like, you know, because from 1968 to 2003, like, that's what happened for this fungus to kind of proliferate so much.
Do you think, and you kind of just gave me an idea, because I was thinking of an ulterior motive, do you think that maybe somebody, so like, okay, I'm not gonna say do you think, I'll say one of my predictions is going to be that by the end of this, like the big twist maybe is that somebody created this as like a form of like population control or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, kind of makes sense, doesn't it?
Mm.
What did the scientist say anything about that in the 60s?
I think he just said about, no, he the only thing he mentioned really was, what if the Earth gets hotter, was the only thing that he said.
Oh yeah, because then it will thrive.
Yeah, because it's always, so like global warming and all that shit, obviously. Which again, yeah, it's a good like tie into kind of like current, you know.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. With everything going up by like a degree or so. Yeah, I mean it's interesting. I don't know the games, which I'm quite grateful for, because now I'm not gonna know what's happening. But yeah, I mean, like I said, it currently is quite conformative to the genre, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. I'm just wondering like why the game was so well received. Because a well done video game isn't necessarily like, you know, it is a different set of parameters to a well done show. But yeah, I mean, I liked the first episode and I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes. So we will touch base.
Same here. I'm glad as well that we've got like, because I was wondering if we were going to have like a show to talk about, like weekly kind of thing. I'm glad that this has popped up.
Mm. And then The Mandalorian's coming back in March, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Have you watched the trailer?
Yeah. I mean, it looked fine.
Yeah, I think it looks all right. I'm actually I'm a bit annoyed because I was saying to myself that I wanted to watch finish like some of the Star Wars animated shows so that kind of like all the Mandalore stuff makes sense, but I've barely even made a dent.
Are they just not good?
It's not that they're not good, it's just that I can only watch animation so much, so like after like two episodes I'm like, okay, yeah, I need to watch something with real people in it.
Yeah, so, fair enough.
I can't binge it, which is annoying. So yeah, I'm having to go very, very slowly. And there's so much of it. Obviously, I'm only on season two of Clone Wars, and then Rebels has got four seasons, and then the Bad Batch just came out with a second season. I'm like, fucking hell. Because I want to watch it all, but I'm just like, it's so much content.
Yeah. Well, we've got this to talk about. I'm sure Chris will be watching it as well when he's next on the pod.
He's only just started watching Andor, for fuck's sake.
Well, you know, I'll save my thoughts for offline. But yeah, I mean, next that I'm watching, I'm going to watch The Fabelmans. I'm going to watch Babylon. Babylon's 3 hours 10. Fabelmans is 2 hours 30.
Yikes.
Yeah, I feel like films are generally getting longer.
I think you're right.
I'm watching a film called Unwelcome, which is a horror film.
Okay.
And my favourite film is being re-released in cinemas, and I've never seen it in the cinema, so I'm looking forward to doing that. That's Donnie Darko.
So, what genre is Donnie Darko?
Psychological thriller.
Okay, I might watch it.
Yeah, it's not like scary. If you've never seen it, definitely watch it. I love it. It's got a young Jake Gyllenhaal in. So yeah, that's on my watch list. What are you hoping to watch?
So I might watch Megan, but I'm not super like enthused to watch it because of like the reviews it's been getting. I want to watch
it for the culture.
Yeah, I think I probably will, to be fair. I want to watch Tar because that's getting tipped for like awards. I think it's out now actually. At least that's what Odin's saying. I still haven't watched the Whitney Houston film. And if it's still out by the time I get back from holiday, then I'm going to give that a watch as well. And yeah, like you say, I'm going to watch Babylon because I have a feeling that film's going to be shit, but I'm going to watch it, obviously.
Have you seen the trailer for Plane?
Is that Jared Butler?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The most Gerard Butler film ever.
Literally, I was thinking like, this is so Gerard Butler. I'm gonna watch it though. I'm gonna watch it, so I'm a schmuck, mate.
You're a schmuck. Coming out with Tar being out in mine. That's annoying. Anyway, that's my problem. Alright, well, good to chat to you. And as usual, you can interact with us, ask questions, let us know your thoughts on the content we've been talking about. We are on Twitter at YSCPodcast17 and we're on Instagram at Your Average Critics.
Keep it sexy.
Peace.